Hey everybody, a real quick note before this live episode at Convergence. If you didn't already know, we opened up a Patreon page. You can find that at patreon.com/skiffyandfanty, or if you go to skiffyandfanty.com, it'll be in the sidebar. Our page includes a number of milestone goals, one of which is translated interviews with authors from abroad to continue our World SF tour. It also includes things like live recordings and so on and so forth. So if you'd like to check it out, you can again go to patreon.com/skiffyandfanty and support our show. Thanks again for listening and for listening to this episode.
Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution. At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T-5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show.
Houston in the blonde, you copy. This is the Skiffy and Fanty podcast. We're okay to go.
Yeah!
Good one.
I'm Julia.
I'm Rachel.
I'm Sean.
I'm Mike.
I'm Paul.
I'm David.
And we're here to talk about Contact and Gravity. So before we get to the specific movies, a couple quick things we got to talk about. One, hold questions, because we're going to have about 10-15 minutes at the tail end where we'll take questions. And then we're also going to have some fun trivia questions so that you guys can win books. They're easy questions. If you've seen one or the other movie, you should be able to get them. There's one really hard one that Paul came up with, but that'll be okay. We're also, as a quick note, we're also doing a hangout if you guys want to come and play board games and just chill at 8 p.m. tonight at the other hotel bar.
That's the Doubletree.
The Doubletree. Yeah, so if you feel like playing some board games like Pandemic or I've got some Star Wars Savic, it's going to be cool. So if you want to come and participate, that's great. So this is going to work pretty simply. We each get 3 minutes to talk about a thing about both movies, and then Paul will yell at them to stop, and then there'll be 3 minutes of people to yell at that person about why they're wrong, and then we will go to you guys, in which you can yell at us about why we're wrong. And there'll be plenty of opportunities, so it should work out. So I think we should start by talking about both of these movies in terms of the plot, in case people don't know the plot. So who would like to tell us about Contact?
Are you looking at me?
I am, now.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Explain
okay.
Contact.
I'll explain Contact. Contact is a movie starring Jodie Foster and Matthew McConaughey. Jodie Foster is Dr. Eleanor Arroyo, who's interested in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence setting. And it depicts her discovery of an interstellar signal from the star Vega and their attempts to decode it and find out it's a machine that sends her to elsewhere, or does it?
Dun, dun, dun.
Or does it?
And what about Gravity?
Gravity is the story of Sandra Bullock, a medical doctor who is sent into space to help repair a satellite that she's repairing. Installing something on the Hubble, and things go drastically wrong, and she ends up having to find her way back to Earth.
The drastically wrong is an orbital debris cascade, which is actually kind of really interesting, isn't it? It's a thing that could kind of happen.
It's
bad.
Perfect. Well, I figured we'll just make this easy, and we'll just start at the end with our first topic of discussion.
Okay.
Julia.
All right, so the topic that I was going to talk about is that both of these movies deal with a main character who is grieving. In Contact, Jodie Foster she lost both her parents when she was young. Her mother died in childbirth, I think, and her father died of a heart attack when she was 9. And part of her desire to find extraterrestrial intelligence is this desire to connect with something bigger than her, and she's an atheist, so there's also kind of a push-pull of faith, but I think someone else is going to dig into that. But I wanted to look at the grief angle in both the movies, where she's really reaching out into the vastness of space and hoping to find connections, whereas in Gravity, Sandra Bullock has lost her daughter, and she's in space, and space is an empty void that is trying to kill you. And she's sort of been shutting herself off from everything in her life after her daughter died. And so for her, the grieving process is kind of pulling herself out of this void of space, literally and figuratively within her own mind. And so I thought it was really interesting that both these movies take the same subject matter, including how we relate to space in our grieving process, and really look at it with very different lenses. And that was kind of what I wanted to look at, the optimism versus the pessimism, space as a void versus space as something that might be teeming with life. I just thought those were interesting contrasts.
Something I said yesterday when we were doing prep is that gravity in particular is almost like a Silent Hill in space. Silent Hill is a video game series in the horror genre, and people will come into the city and it creates a series of challenges and terrors that are kind of inspired by and drawn from this a person's history and their grief. And if you successfully move through Silent Hill, you can move on with your life. And that the story in Gravity is this hyper-intense space thriller almost version of that Silent Hill model where the Sandra Bullock character moves through these different challenges and begins very uncertain and very kind of bounded by grief and has to continually move outside herself. So there's this externalization of that grieving locus, which I think is very interesting and a different process than the way that that the character moves through it in Contact.
Yeah, though I would say, like, you know, in Gravity, the big difference between that and Silent Hill is that there's not a lot of sex equals death in Gravity.
That's very true.
There's a lot of that in Silent Hill. But one thing I also wanted to bring up is there's a companion short film to Gravity that I don't know how many people have seen it. If you actually just, like, Google Gravity short film or something like that, it'll come up. And it's when she's having that conversation with the guy who doesn't speak English over the radio, and she's talking to him. The short film is actually the other end of that conversation. And I'm going to go ahead and spoil it because it's actually very important to what Julia was talking about. Because what it is it's an Icelandic, I don't know if he's a hunter or a fisherman or something, but he's on his radio trying to contact a veterinarian because he has a dog who is very old and very, very sick. And you know, you get the impression that he's had this dog forever, and she's very important to him. And he's trying to contact the veterinarian to ask if there's a way to, you know, to save her, or if he should put her down. And after his conversation with Sandra Bullock, which I think he even says, like, this dog is so important to me, she's everything to me, I can't let her go. Then after this conversation, he decides that he needs to go shoot the dog and put her out of her misery. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's a really interesting thematic counterpoint.
Well, I mean, it's just the dog is obviously very sick and suffering, and yeah. But
So Gravity manages, in the end, to be another movie where the dog dies.
Yeah.
Basically.
It's like, that's the saddest thing I've heard since I read the Richard Matheson novella.
Oh, God.
Yeah, pretty much. Earlier we watched The Omega Man, and I read the original book that it's based on, and it has the saddest chapter I've ever read in a science fiction book involving a dead dog.
Well, and we're about ready for our next topic.
Yeah. All right, well, we will jump to you, Rachel.
Okay, so I wanted to talk about the whole female protagonist thing, because they're both movies with female protagonists. And it's kind of interesting because, despite the fact that both movies have female protagonists, neither of them actually passed the Bechdel test, as far as I can tell, because there are some very brief conversations between two women, particularly in Contact, but they're not 30 seconds. So that's kind of like, And what's kind of interesting is that one thing I really like about Contact, and I could beat up on that movie a lot, but it's the fact that there you can look at it as a woman who works in the sciences and really connect with how screwed Jodie Foster's character gets again and again and again, because there's the really weaselly guy who, like, every time she's like, I've discovered a thing, then the next scene is him being like, and this thing that I discovered is, like, right here, and she's just standing there kind of, like, eating it, because, of course, you're in the sciences and you're a woman, and you're trying to be a team player, so you can't just be like, this guy's an asshole and he stole my stuff. So that, I actually really appreciated that. In Contact, I did not appreciate the other sleazy guy who is played by Matthew McConaughey, who I have a really hard time describing why, but that entire relationship really creeps me out.
Is it because he doesn't shower?
I think it has everything to do with whether you're a fan of Matthew McConaughey or not.
Actually, the thing is, I really like Matthew McConaughey, though I was very confused when I first saw the movie because he's like baby Matthew McConaughey and he looks kind of like Owen Wilson, but I was like, this couldn't be Owen Wilson because Owen Wilson was like an embryo back then, so I was super confused. So there's that, and then Gravity, I remember I was really thrilled by the fact that the main character is played by Sandra Bullock, and initially, I didn't really recall like there being anything all that problematic about it, because she's a female astronaut. She's very competent. Actually, it could maybe kind of pass the Bechdel test, because she has a little back and forth with the shuttle commander, who is also a woman, who then gets killed by the orbital debris cascade. But I also did notice, like, in her back and forth with Kowalski, who's played by...
George Clooney.
Thank you. I'm so bad with names. He does some teasing about, like, you know, like, Ryan, what kind of name is that for a girl, or you think I'm really attracted, don't you? And the way it's played, there's not really anything really gross behind it. He's mostly doing it to try to just keep her talking, but it's still kind of interesting in that interplay because it's between a male and a female character.
Yeah. I wanted to pick up on your comment about the relationship between McConaughey and Foster.
Yes, maybe you can describe why it's sleazy.
Well, what bothered me was that we have it's established that Tom Skerritt is a villain because he screws with Foster's career, but then tells her that it's for her own good because she's not going to be taken seriously for this. And her response is justifiable anger, it's my life. But then McConaughey essentially does exactly the same thing. When he sabotages her in her application to go and, you know, take the voyage on the machine, and so brings up the question, does she believe in God? And so now he says that he does that. It turns out the real reason he did that is not because that he actually believed that that was what was motivating him, is that he didn't want to lose her. So he sabotaged her because he wanted to keep her safe. So essentially the same rationale, I'm doing this for your own good.
And it's not even that he didn't want to lose her, it's that he didn't want her to go into space.
Guys, yeah. Next to me, Sean is kind of like vibrating with rage. So, I mean, like literally, like,
and,
really.
And the film wants us to take that as charming, and then she takes his hand and kisses him when she should be beating him up.
Yeah, basically, yeah. He's like, I'm going to destroy your career dreams so that you can be with me.
Key difference between Drumlin and Palmer is that Palmer actually apologizes to her. Now, you can, whether or not you take that apology seriously, whatever. He actually takes the effort to say, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done it. What Drumlin does is when he has the opportunity to say, I'm sorry that I took advantage, right, and admit, like, I was wrong, you know, you were right this whole time, there are freaking aliens out there. What he does, he says, man, I really wish the world were a fair place and everything worked out the way it is, but we don't live in that world. Now I'm going to give my shit-eating grin about the lovable Elmer, the little test doll, and I'm going to walk away. He never apologizes. It's very clear that he gives no two shits about her.
Oh, no, he wears the black hat all the way through.
Up until he dies.
And really, that's quickly, what I find different. I will say that I think Contact probably does pass the Bechdel test, barely, because the leader of the international coalition to try to decide who's going to go into space is a woman, and she actually does have a pretty extensive conversation with Jodie Foster, where she's questioning her about whether she believes in God, and Jodie Foster keeps being like, I don't understand the relevance of that question, and they kind of go back and forth quite a few times, so that's not... The Bechdel test is it has to be two women talking to each other, not about a man, and I have to have a substantive conversation. So I think that.
Well, I mean, technically speaking, depending on which god you ascribe to.
And I mean, I'll admit that the romantic storyline is not particularly well constructed. I mean, it's obvious there is one, but it sort of comes out of the blue where he's like, "Oh, the reason why is because, like, I love you."
And time.
Yeah. So, I guess it's my turn, and it's where I get to talk about things before David talks about it. But we'll argue later. I want to actually talk about the way in which the films deal with faith. Because one of the things that I really loved about Contact is that we get to the end of the film and we have this sort of symbolic marriage between religion proper and science. You could have some problems with that, but I actually really appreciated that there is an effort throughout the film to actually put the two things together, and you can kind of think of Palmer Ross as a little kind of weird. I mean, he's accused of being New Agey in the film by, who is the guy? Is it Rob Lowe?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Rob Lowe, who's, I guess, supposed to be, like, the Southern Baptist guy. But what's great about him is, like, you know, he says at the very end, after she's had this experience, and they try to basically destroy her publicly, and they ask him whether or not he believes her, and he says, well, we share a different covenant, right? Him with sort of religious angle, her, she's driven by science, but yet they come to the same conclusions, right, which is about the nature of truth. And everyone accuses Palmer Ross throughout the film of, like, he hates technology, he wants to ruin technology for good. There's no actual evidence that he ever does. In fact, what he says is, I don't have a problem with technology, I have a problem with what technology does to us, right? And what he's looking for is ultimately human truth. So I love that that's what the film deals with, and it gets to the end where we have this sort of character who's presented a scientific truth, but she can't relate it to the rest, so she has to kind of take a faith gesture. And I actually really appreciated that as a way of trying to finding a way to bridge the two things. Gravity takes a somewhat very different pathway. I almost got the kind of impression of, if there's a religious angle to this, it's a very sort of, like, Gaia Earth is a wonderful place, let's all come and hang out. And I think the great symbol of that is, you know, there are a number of points where we see sort of, like, umbilical elements throughout. I mean, I think throughout the spaceships that she gets into are always kind of figured as being a kind of a womb, outside of which is just horrors and terrors. But when she gets to Earth, there's that beautiful moment where, you know, she's swimming in the water, and then she gets to the water, and she crawls out, and you have this sort of evolution as she finally stands. But her response to the planet is, of course, thank you. That's what she says to Earth. She's holding the dirt, and she says thank you, and there's this deep connection, almost religious connection, with the Earth. And I know we'll talk about optimism and pessimism a little bit later, but that's part of what I really liked about Gravity. And I didn't like it the first time. When I watched Gravity the first time, I thought all the symbols were, like, it was just too obvious, right? It's sort of like banging me over the head with a stick. But when I started really watching it, thinking about how all these things communicate with each other, I thought it was just really beautiful. So, and I really like Contact. So, yay. Sorry.
I'll bring it. There's a string going through. Hold on for a second. There's a string going through Gravity, though, that you didn't touch on, because she talks about prayer.
She does, yeah.
She's like, I don't know how to pray. I never learned how to pray. I'm not quite sure whether she was an agnostic turned atheist. I get the feeling that the loss of her daughter really changed her spiritual direction in a way. And maybe what Gravity is all about is reconnecting with Mother Earth, because of other themes and strains that go throughout the movie beyond the faith. But I think there's almost there, as you were saying, almost like a Mother Earth sort of approach to how she's looking at her. Because I'll get that when I get to my point. I mean, everything they focus on in the movie is in Gravity is looking back at Earth, how beautiful Earth is.
Yeah.
I don't think it's just connecting with Earth, because that whole conversation she has with the guy who shoots his dog. But, you know, she spends all this time kind of going, like, will you pray for me? Will you mourn for me? So it's also about the fact that she has isolated herself so completely because of the death of her daughter. And you know, she's finally... And you notice that is the turning point in the movie. That and Kowalski kind of showing up and you know, Ghost Kowalski showing up and just being like, yeah, it's so easy to just turn everything off and drift away. But it's that the rekindling of that desire to connect with other people.
Yeah. Any other thoughts on that?
I think David's like saving it up, and actually probably David should go.
Let's jump to David. Bring it.
Okay, so I find both films frustrating in the whole faith and science debate. Contact more so. I'm a little more forgiving with Gravity because of its relentless upholstery clawing suspense.
Yes!
But both movies have atheist or agnostic protagonists who wind up in places that can be read as maybe different at the end. It's a little bit hard to tell, and I find that ambiguity is for me a bug, not a feature. It feels like the movie's trying to have it both ways or refusing to commit. I have more respect for the position taken by something like The Ninth Configuration, which I disagree with fundamentally, you know, every frame of that film, but I enjoy the argument that it, the way it makes its argument, I felt respected by it. Contact for me is the greater sinner here, and Robert Zemeckis is a very safe filmmaker. He feels like Steven Spielberg with all the edges filed off, and not that Spielberg files off his own edges.
Yeah, Spielberg doesn't have any edges.
And so on the one hand, so for instance, the question of fate isn't pursued rigorously enough. The debate is essentially reduced to, is our volunteer religious? When the theological impact of the existence of aliens is largely ignored. I am thinking of Arthur C. Clarke's statement that the rash assertion that God made man in his own image is ticking like a time bomb at the foundation of many faiths. And the reason we wind up at the end with the sad spectacle of Eli Arroway pleading for people to have faith is, I think, a failure of the imagination. Certainly, partly Sagan's, the ending of the book never satisfied me, but at least it's more international than what we get in the film, and it is a cop-out. And worse is the visualization. The search for the spiritual is understandable in this kind of thing, sort of trying to go for the sublime and the numinous. But instead we get banal utterings of so beautiful, so beautiful, so beautiful, so beautiful, during, which reminded me of Singing in the Rain's hilarious, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you.
Oh,
and after all this travel, we wind up with an encounter with Ghost Dad on Gilligan's Island. You know, I think only one film has managed to do the numinous journey through the Stargate well, and that was 2001, a collaboration between a hard SF writer and a filmmaker so cold, it has been said of Kubrick that if Hitchcock has no heart, Kubrick had no soul.
Oh my God.
So, and yet there, I think it does, it achieves the sublime in a way that Contact reaches for explicitly and just gives us the banal.
See, and I just want to know, okay, the thing about the ending of Contact that just drives me up a wall is, you know, she gets transported billions of light years or whatever to Gilligan's Island, and there's Ghost Dad, and she's like, what do you mean I won't have any evidence that this ever happened, and this is dumb, and he's like, well, this is how we've always done it. Bye!
Argument from authority.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I was just sitting there going, you know, in a story that was written by Carl Sagan, the aliens completely defend a basically a logical fallacy about why this is the best way to do things. We're going to take one person and we're going to give them an experience, and then we're going to send them back so that everyone thinks they're crazy. Aliens are dicks!
To be fair, the novel had an international team.
Okay, so at least they could back up their mass hallucination.
And they say at the end, we need to connect together, we need to keep remembering this, because they have no physical proof, but we know what happened, we have to make sure we stick together.
Right. Well, the film shows that the character's experience was real, that there was 18 hours of static recorded somehow in several seconds.
They know
but
it's
then
happened.
So the powers that be know it's happened, but they never let the lead know. So that the lead character never gets their kind of validated experiential documentation, which I think is a massive disservice to the character, because it kind of forces her character arc onto a whole different trajectory.
Well, yeah, and it's basically like the story gaslights the character.
Yeah.
Well, which is very problematic.
But at the same time, like, what did you expect was going to happen? James Woods' character is a sleazeball throughout, trying to national security.
He's not
excuse
a sleazeball.
He's a sleazeball.
He's not a sleazeball.
Yeah, but he feels plot motivated. It's not. It feels like Sagan. And the story got to the point. Okay, here's the journey to the aliens, and I don't really know how to really conclude this. You know, and so we get the science fictional equivalent of horrors you've been dead all along. It's the Stargate, mysterious numinous, can't explain, and we return effectively to the status quo with the possibility of something changed.
Yeah, because if it were really national security, there is no way that Foster's character would not have been brought in to whatever department, because she's the only person who would have had that experience. Because they, experientially through documentation, know that something happened. And instead, she's given a stipend and sent off to talk to kids.
Well, but they take her statement.
Well,
no, but
they,
she would be theirs. She would be in the main insider from then on.
Well, and I guess the other reason that bothers me just logically is that obviously it's not just, you know, dickbag that knows that this happened. It's because that's how we find out at the end that it actually did. The lady's like, sorry, this thing happened, and no one's gonna fucking tell Ellie. Okay. Yeah. Assholes.
Well,
so Mike?
Mike. All right, so...
We're earning our mature tag.
I know, right?
It's all me. Hi.
So the first time I went and saw Gravity, something struck me at the very beginning. They, you know, it gives some facts about space and such things, but then the final card is life in space is impossible. And from the very beginning, it's like, oh, this might not be my kind of movie. Because... watching Contact the first time through, you know, as a teenager, and it presented with problems that I didn't really notice because 14-year-old me had zero levels in feminism, that there is hope, there is optimism, like there's a reason to believe that there's a future, that there's somebody out there. The argument of, if we're the only ones here, it seems like an awful big waste of space. And like that kind of presentation, that thesis for the film, which is not necessarily its only thesis, is kind of outward-looking, and it says that there is a future, and then Gravity comes along and says, life in space is impossible, and then spends 90 minutes punishing characters for the temerity of having gone into space, going so far as to be actually science fiction because it's counterfactual physics. Like, a lot of the physics just don't work, and the universe has conspired against people being in space. And... you know, the entire space program is obliterated by this cascade of debris, so that Ryan, the only survivor, kind of, it seems like the lesson she's learned is, like, get GTFO of space, like, stay on Earth, Earth is good for you, like, be appreciative of Earth, grieve, move on, do that thing. So these films are really divergent in terms of whether they suggest that we should look outward, or they suggest that we should kind of be grateful for what we have and stick around. And I think looking at their respective historical periods, so 97 in the States at least is mostly a time, it's a feast time. You have incredible economic growth. And then in 2013, we've had, and this Cuarón being a non-American director kind of means that this should be a little bit more global, which maybe people can unpack. But, you know, this is post 9/11. This is NASA having largely been kind of stripped back. The space travel not really being an American or a North American thing anymore. Other forces and private forces are taking that into their hands. So each of them, I think, are notably of their time. But Gravity tells us we don't belong in space. And then in a broader discussion, we could look at Interstellar and some other works where there are counterpoints to those arguments. And then the book The Martian by Andy Weir, and which will then have a film. So we're having this discussion about, do we belong in space, which I think it's fun to look back at Contact and see how that discussion has evolved over time.
Okay.
All right, well, I have thoughts.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, well, I said I was going to have a controversial opinion about Gravity, and my opinion is essentially that it goes along with what you're saying, which is that I find Contact an infinitely more enjoyable film to watch. Because I go to watch Gravity, and I get to the end of it, and I'm it's gut-punching. I mean, it's, like, we get to the end of that, and it literally is, like, yeah, stay the frick out of space. Don't go up there. It's a horrible place. I find that vision really stifling. And the film itself is very stifling, and intentionally so, right? It's just tension throughout as things get increasingly worse and worse until she's running out of places to go. But then you get to Contact, and we get this, you know, just the idea that they would spend, half a trillion dollars building this massive machine, and then they would build another one, which is like, so they spent like $1 trillion building this massive machine sent by aliens using Hitler, right? Like, just think about that. Like, we have to be super optimistic, or somehow someone really convinced all, like, Bill Clinton, who kind of shows up in the movie via stock footage, right? Bill Clinton, like, either he was really high, or he was having a little bit of extra fun and he wasn't paying attention. But that's extremely optimistic that we would do this incredible project, and we just do it. And it wasn't like a big question. It's like a year later, we got this massive machine. What do you do? Let's just drop a person through it, whatever. Right? Yeah. Sure. Well, of course they had to have it. But I love that because you get to the end of that film, and even though she's had this sort of faith-based experience, right? She's experienced it, but she can't explain it to everybody. She goes outside the doors, and what is this? All the people going, "We believe you, we believe you." And there's like thousands of people lined up outside on the street. It's beautiful.
And it
feels good.
And I think these days, if you tried to film that, it'd be lots of people saying, "Well, we don't believe you. Like, you're skeptic. You've wasted the taxpayers' money." I think you were right. We live in a much more skeptical and diminished age, where we're not so convinced that space is the future and space is what we want and what we need.
Our future's dead.
Well, I think I don't think we have as strong dreams of going to space.
We don't.
No, we have folks in the audience for podcast listeners wearing Star Trek uniforms, and historically within the genre, David is the reason why I say genre like that now. there have been strong visions and strong narratives pointing outward, and in the last few years we've been kind of having back and forth on that.
So I just want to point out that in Contact, in the end, I think they have told Ellie that they believe her because she's allowed to add more satellite dishes to try to pick up bigger signals. And when you see her at the end talking to children in the desert, she's actually said, like, "I've added all these extra dishes, we're trying to pick up more signals," because they believe that this thing has happened. And she's still fully committed to her work. But the interesting thing about that is that no one has tried to send anyone else back out into space to search for more life. It's all about trying to get more signals to come to Earth.
That's it. Very interesting, and it's time.
Darn it.
Okay.
All right.
Comes to me in the depiction of space travel and space programs in both movies. And gravity is very much the vastness, coldness of space. We see a very international approach to space. We have the American Space Shuttle. We have the Hubble Space Telescope. But where does Sandra Bullock's character go? She has to go to the International Space Station, where most of the stuff is in Russian. And when things go completely wrong on the space station, and fire consumes it, and the debris shot comes at it, where does she have to go? The Chinese space station, and that's where she can finally find the plot device where she can get back to Earth. So while space is vast and unforgiving and cold and deadly and we need to get out of space, at least when we were in space, it was an international effort. We had Americans, we had Russians, we had Chinese. I think one of the other guy on the shuttle mission was Indian.
Yeah, he's Indian.
So it's a very much more, okay, the whole world has gone to space, but now the whole world has to come back from space and is being cleansed from it. Contact, on the other hand, is rah-rah America space program all the way. Americans do find the signal, but then really from the beginning, James Woods' character saying, "Oh, we have to take this in." The head of the White House says, "Yes, we have to make sure we have to understand American interests. Americans build this half trillion dollar machine, and for other people having concessions, I mean, most of the final 10 candidates are all Americans." I think they said 7 out of 10 candidates were Americans. And then what happens when the machine goes boom? And, "Oh, we built another in Japan, but what does Joan Hurst's character say? They still want an American to go." I found that really interesting. It's like, why an American? Why couldn't it have been somebody else? I mean, yes, it has to be Jodie Foster for plot reasons, but no, we want another American to go. And then when we move on and we see things going on, everybody in that whole facility is all Americans again. It's the exact same team as from the last one. You can got some more Japanese, say? No, unfortunately. But I'll move on from the space film to the actual depiction of space. Gravity is absolutely beautiful film. It depresses the hell out of me. It was absolutely beautiful film in showing the vastness and coldness of space. I'm running out of time. We get the nice zooms out. We see just how small things are in the vastness of space, and then we can zoom in on people. Contact relies on a lot of stock imagery. Everything in the second half, when she goes through that wormhole, is an image we've seen before in the film, on a wall, on a painting, on a screensaver. So it's all taken from her mind. It's beautiful stuff, the black hole, the galaxy, and everything else, but it's all out of her mind now, everything we've seen before, and that's my time.
Okay, wow. So, I mean, one, and actually, I think a lot of that actually ties into what Mike was talking about, but you know, I would like to point out on the optimism versus pessimism grounds that life in space literally is impossible without, you know, taking your own air with you and all that. So,
unless you're a star child.
Yeah, well, you know, unless you're a space whale. But, like, so in a sense, gravity is very pessimistic, but in a sense, gravity is also being realistic by being like, space is a really scary and dangerous place. Yep. Yeah. And, you know, to me, well, I get that she kind of gets chased back to Earth. I also kind of have, like, Apollo 13 feels about it, because Apollo 13 was basically like, wow, space is really dangerous and it's going to kill you. We have to figure out a way to get you back home. And you know, it's her figuring out, like, again and again how to, like, okay, I need to get to the next place to go home. I need to get to the next place. So, and with that, like, the space program thing with gravity, I did love the internationalism of it, that we created, an entire Chinese space station so that it could apparently fall out of into the atmosphere and burn up, but, you know, everything kind of sucked in space at that moment.
A quick correction. So, in Contact, the team of 10 people, one-third of them are American.
Oh, one-third? Okay, those.
Yeah, it's mentioned, it's still made a big deal of, though, because I forget the name of the president's, like, second in command. Yeah, I can't remember her character's name, though. But she says, she shows up on TV and they say, like, well, but sorry, but for only one-third is, so why should the Americans have so many candidates? And her response is, because we're fronting most of the burden. Right, and that's her, but of course, the focus, you're right, the focus throughout the film in Contact is it's very American focused. If we hear about other people, we don't really see them. Like, Japan basically builds both things, right? They opt out of sending people into space in order to get the contracts to build the machines. And the only time we see the Japanese people is there's a brief moment, really, when she's being put in the machine, and they're like, what's up, machine? And then they walk away, and that's it.
Which is kind of interesting, because in today's context, the Japanese actually have a big presence on the International Space Station, and they have an entire module on the space station that's the Kibo Robotics Lab. I didn't know if people were aware of that.
I did not know that.
Yes. It is very cool. They're doing robots in space, because that's what the Japanese do.
Yeah, but I do think that you're right, that gravity does a better job of giving us diversity.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we have, as you said, like, this Icelandic guy she has a conversation with. There's the Indian fellow. There's three different stations from three different... Well, and even the International Space Station is itself, right, it's called the International Space Station, so hopefully someone who is an American shows up sometimes.
Well, all stuff is in Russian, so they must.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's... The ISS, like, yeah, it's people, it's like Russia, you get people from JAXA, you get people from all over the European Union. It's like, Houston sucks, but if you ever get a chance to go to Houston, go down to NASA. And they have, like, this entire wall that is a picture of every crew that has gone into space. And actually, you know, there's like a little black band on all the ones that have people who died during training or during launch or whatever. And if nothing else, you can stand back and look at the number of people that have been sent in space and so few have actually died, which is very impressive. But, when you start getting to the lower where it's all the ISS missions, it's like people from Japan and people from Canada and the Russians never smile, except there's, like, this one guy who keeps going on missions, and, like, you can watch this progression where at first he's, like, being totally Russian, and then you get, like, this little smile, because, I don't know, they've, like, beaten him up enough that he starts smiling, and everyone else is like, yeah, we're going to space, and the Japanese guy's like...
For those listening at home, Rachel's face just did a giant, giant grin. So we're about to take audience questions, but I want to just finish off our discussion of these movies with a fun trivia fact that I discovered, which is that the plot of Gravity is actually the same plot as the series finale of the sitcom Family Matters.
Wait, what?
What?
In the end of the sitcom Family Matters, Stephen Urkel goes up into space to repair a satellite and then finds himself in the same predicament as Sandra Bullock.
What?
What?
Okay, wait a minute. What?
This
what?
Is amazing.
Look it up on the internet, guys. It's real.
Oh,
that's why
God.
That's why Gravity happened, because they put him in space.
That explains so much.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
Mind blown.
He was the guy. They put him in charge of blowing up the Russian spy satellite, which led the debris field.
With the whole thing with blowing up the Russian, all I could think was the movie 1, 2, 3, where the guy's like, In Russia, we have two buttons. One to blow up missile, one to blow up missile science.
Well, okay, so now is the time where you guys get to say stuff. So...
in the middle.
Have at it, sir.
Yeah, I had something to say. You were talking about the gut punch at the end of Gravity. It may not seem like much by comparison, but there is also a kind of a gut punch at the end of Contact. Because Ellie is told that although you are ready for contact with aliens, and some people you know may be ready for contact with aliens, Earth is not ready, and not only do the powers that be on Earth think so, so do the aliens.
True.
Yeah, see, this goes back to my thesis that the aliens are dicks. Mm-hmm. Like, they're very, the most paternalistic aliens where they're like, oh, you know, well, you're a kid.
Well, but they've been around for, like, millions of years.
Exactly,
like,
and that's why...
Your argument from authority makes me angry! Yeah.
Well, okay.
That's why it's such a big sucker punch. Because not only do our stupid, apparently stupid authorities think this, but aliens who have been around for thousands of years also think this.
Yeah.
So I also have to wonder how long aliens actually have been around, because there's no evidence either way.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
When she talks to them, they're like... we didn't actually come up with the schematics for this thing. Someone else did. We don't know who.
It's the wormholes.
Yeah.
Yeah, the wormholes were put there by someone else.
Which
they don't know who.
And actually, that is actually the reason that bothers me so much, because it's basically they're using borrowed technology, but, you know, that they didn't come up with. They're not, like, the masters of the wormholes, but they're like, no, we're going to be the gatekeepers of this entire thing.
It's like the Guru from Stargate decided to control all the Stargates everywhere.
Look, the film doesn't do a good job of setting this up, but there's a really, I think, telling moment when they ask her, you know, what is the reason for why, what was the question you would ask them, right, when you first get to the aliens? And her response is, like, how did you do it? But there's this long conversation about that she has in all these interviews, right, where she says things like, you know, we're at this moment of massive change, right, technological change, we're at the brink of destruction, like, every day. Right, so how did you survive this technological adolescence is the question she asked. Because clearly they have survived it. And it's clear when she gets there, like, they've got all this cool fancy stuff. They have survived
that they took
it.
From a dead thing. I don't
dead
know.
Alien,
sure,
alien
yeah.
race.
But
yeah.
the problem that is that she never actually asks the question.
Yeah.
She gets there and
she
hugs
her dad.
She has daddy pain, and then she's
Robert Zemeckis pizza.
Yeah, but I think that's what the film is trying to suggest, is that's why we're not ready, is because at any moment we might nuke each other.
Or now more pointedly kill us over climate change.
Well, oh, sure, but in 1997, they had no idea what was going on.
But it does tend to make the entire thing a gigantic practical joke on the part of the aliens. Here's a clever way of making these people spend $1 trillion. Well, yes, the alien teenagers who burn planets land in front of some poor soul no one's ever going to believe and walk up and down in front of him making beep-beep noises.
But at least in the book, they point out that Earth gets a lot of new technology, metallurgy and composition and other stuff out of it. So at least in the book... Earth does materially benefit.
But why are we assuming that the aliens even know what money is?
Or that they're organized.
Apparently,
or that they're organized. Maybe it's just like one guy who just runs around stealing people who've lost their dad.
Yeah. Well, no, I was going to say, apparently the aliens know what Pensacola is, so...
Well, aliens read her thoughts and they could see her memories, so they built it on that.
And she has
no memories of money?
Well, she
is a research scientist, so it's not like she's ever actually
seen
money. Let's be honest.
But at the same time, right, like, just because she has money, it doesn't mean they understand. Like, they could look at it and go, why do you give paper for items? This is stupid.
It only
makes sense to us, because we've been using money, but, like, honestly, if we were, like, you know, 5,000 years ago...
I'm sorry, if they're, like, reading and comprehending her thoughts, I think they could be like, money makes the world go round. Money makes the radio telescopes operate.
Also, if we were 5,000 years ago, we'd be bartering and trading and using other forms of currency, which might not be paper, but, like, I don't think money is that hard of a concept.
Yes, I will give you a thing, and you will give me a thing in return.
Alright,
does anyone else have a question?
Sorry.
I think we're going to move on to trivia, then.
Okay, so we have five books to give away. You can see them all here. I'm going to hold them up and say their titles. We have The Lives of Tao by guest of honor this weekend, Wesley Chu. And we have The Waterborne Blade by Susan Murray. These are both Angry Robot books that are given to us courtesy of Mike Underwood, who works with Angry Robot. We have The Damnation of, is it Pythos?
Pythos.
And this lovely Yarrick, The Pyres of Armageddon by David Annandale.
Angry man on the cover.
As David just said, his arm has been ripped off by an orc, so you would probably be angry in that situation as well. So these are both by David Annandale. And
so you could get the author to sign them.
You could totally get the author to sign them.
And last. Books
already. And then we have The Year's Best YA Speculative Fiction 2013, which I co-edited with Elisa Krasenstein in Australia. So it's got lots of good stories featuring teen protagonists. And those are what we have to offer. We have 5 trivia questions about the movies. So we're going to ask them, and then whoever answers correctly gets to choose a book.
Okay, so question number 1. What sound does Sandra Bullock's character make to communicate to the Icelander on Earth?
Can you raise your hand? Yeah, you got it.
Oh, you mean what sound over the radio, or how does she try to communicate?
Right.
I thought she was going mono... like I-O, you know what I mean? She was varying her vocal pitch to get a broader brand, you know.
But what sound is she
trying
to
make? I realized
what she was doing, but I can't remember.
The question, I think, is not necessarily clear. What we're asking is, when Sandra Bullock realizes that this person does not speak her language, she finds a way to connect with them by making a certain sound that they will understand because it's also being made on the other end.
Yes. Can you
demonstrate that for us? Yeah!
Yeah.
All right.
A+.
Come up and get a book.
Yeah. Come get a book.
All right. Okay. Next question.
What site is the transmission first received at?
What planet?
Let's be more specific.
Where is the transmission first received?
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah.
It's
the Arecibo.
No.
That, remember, because she's at Arecibo, and then they get kicked out because that one guy is
because Tom Skerritt is evil. So yeah. You had your hand up. Do you have an answer?
I was going to guess
Okay. Nope.
In the middle.
It's just the one in New Mexico with the very large array.
Yes! Yeah.
Come up and get a book.
All right. Third question.
Third question. In Gravity, what is Sandra Bullock's character's profession?
Other than spacewalker.
Yes. This wasn't even supposed to be the hard one.
With the green shirt.
Yes!
You got it. Come get a book, sir.
Okay.
Alright, question 4.
Number 4. In what year was the novel Contact published?
Oh my god.
Yes.
You wrote this one?
No, David wrote it. So you can get David to sign it.
All right. Of course. So what year was Contact written in?
The novel. What year was it published? Yep.
It was the late 80s. I'm going to guess 87.
Yeah. Really close.
Oh, so close.
So close.
Close.
Are you going to be in the bar later?
Got a second guess?
87!
Yeah!
Yeah, come on up and get a book.
Okay.
Whatever you want.
All right. And a final question. What award did both films win?
Special effects?
No.
Bonus, it's an award, but in a different category that our podcast was nominated for.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
That's going to be a Hugo.
Indeed.
Yeah. Indeed a Hugo.
Hugo Award.
Yes, they both won Best Dramatic Presentation.
Yeah.
You got to get this one.
Thank you all for playing trivia with us.
Yeah.
Yes.
We still have 9 minutes.
Yeah, we still have 9 minutes.
And we also wanted to say that at our meetup this evening, we will be giving away 5 more books. So if you happen to want to win another book, you could come to our meetup at the bar tonight.
Meetup's so great.
It'll be fun. And there'll be games. I'm bringing Savic, which if you want to bring money, we can gamble. But we're
not I will be gambling a spaceship. What could possibly go wrong?
I'm teasing. No gambling. I brought Savic. I've got Pandemic.
Pandemic is amazing. It's one of my favorite games. I mean, team board games are really, really awesome, and Pandemic's nice because you can play a game in less than an hour.
So I'm wanna
like Arkham Horror.
I wanna come back to the movie since we do have a little extra time.
I was gonna say we could even bring Interstellar into this and then I can
Specifically talk about Gravity, because Rachel, at the beginning of the panel you said that what happens is the cascade of debris is a real thing that could happen and that's scary and that the science of that is really interesting. Rachel is a geologist, so she knows her science. She was on an Ask a Scientist panel yesterday. I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about the science.
Well, I mean, mostly I am not a physicist. I didn't do that great in physics because the physics department at CU Boulder is really evil because they have Nobel Prize winners, so they're like, we're going to make all of our undergrads suffer. But, I mean, basically, I just know that the orbital debris cascade is actually a very real concern because there is so much, which is weird to think about because there's so much surface area there, but there's actually a lot of junk in space, and because of the way, you know, we're not in Star Trek and we don't have shields, even like, you know, a little nut off of something is traveling fast enough that if it hits something else, it will punch a big hole in it and transfer a lot of energy.
What about a dispersion? I mean, when I saw that, I'm like, well, the dispersion on that would be working pretty aggressively, both with gravity.
Well, that's actually why the whole idea of the orbital debris cascade is actually feasible, is because all you need is one collision, and then that's going to set off, you know, basically something else is going to pretty much explode, so then you're going to get a wider area covered, and that wider area, that debris will hit other things.
Right.
Well, and that'll actually also mean that not only do you get it on that altitude, it'll start spreading over more altitudes.
Well, I agree, but when you talk about probability and the mass and the, you know, and the velocity necessary and the band, the satellite band is pretty massive.
It is.
And especially when you talk about the mass of the satellite over a 1 mile area, if it's a half meter mass satellite over a 1 mile area, that's 1 in 1,000. But then you cube that, so you got what in a million.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying that this is a thing that's going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah, it's just mostly a
big concern because it's like, you know, yeah, we know this is not going to, like, statistically, this is not necessarily something that's bound to happen, but it's kind of like the Earth getting hit by a meteor where you're just kind of like, if it does happen, it would be really bad and we'd lose all of our satellites. And then the worst part of it is, then you wouldn't be able to launch any new satellites for a while because there'd be so much junk in space, they'd just get taken down again.
Well, eventually it burns
and
up.
Eventually it'll burn up, but a lot of that depends on your orbital trajectories. And, I mean, that's why a lot of times they're trying to put more thought into, okay, if you have an old satellite, you need to bring it down out of orbit and let it burn up in the atmosphere so that it's not up there.
Well, and I agree with you again. And then it becomes a question, again, another mass question. I mean, it's the whole reason why we're still using the rocket the Germans invented. I mean, we're still kicking, that's what the Russian boosters are based on. The whole idea, and if you watch the Russian booster assembly, that the last step is a guy with a ranch boat's neck. And NASA's been using it because it's simple, it works, and you could increase the boost, you can increase the mass of the satellite. You can build in the shields, you know, or types of shielding, or types of re-gyrocompassing things that are thrown out, or things that you can nudge satellites, which is why Star Wars never worked with Reagan, and they ran the numbers on it. You could so easily counter it by simple mass increase. Right now, everything is on such a small variation of mass projection based on lift. If you were to cut that down, when you launch something into space, if you cut down the effective science mass of the payload and you added in nudge capability for mild shielding or mild, you know, dust projection, that's my whole point. I mean, this is a 12-pack of beer and a big whiteboard over a weekend.
Yeah.
But I think it's numbers. I think there's a lot of numbers involved. And it's all
numbers. Well, I mean, like, the whole getting mass off the Earth thing is, like, you know, that's the biggest obstacle we have to getting in space because mass is so expensive, especially water.
I agree. Sure. And I'm going to add one more thing, which is really cool. And I think about these two movies, and a lot of the elements out of these two movies go back to Homer in the Odyssey.
Yeah.
When he's coming back. When you talk about either in Contact, you know, or, you know, it's just there's so much that goes back to that basic human idea of going into an element we're not aware of. And that's the Icelandic thing.
Yeah.
I'm an old search and rescue in the Arctic, and it's one of those things that you're going into an element that's just going to kill you in so many different ways. When I watched it, I didn't realize, I thought, well, space isn't so bad.
Oxygen, there's radios, you can talk to people, but it's the same thing.
Well, and that's actually the reason that they made that character Icelandic, is they were drawing that parallel between kind of like the sort of life void of the Arctic and space, but then you can also consider the implication that, yes, life in the Arctic is basically the next best thing to being in space, but there are people who live there.
And dogs
that get shot.
So we have to close pretty quick here, but I want to ask a science question, Rachel, since you're a resident scientist.
Oh, God. This never goes well.
Welcome to Ask a Scientist, round two.
Yeah. This is a really, really important question. Can we solve the debris problem if we just stick giant magnets up there?
I think you should ask Neil deGrasse Tyson.
But I'm asking you. I want your expert opinion. If we stick giant magnets in space...
Okay, so... there's actually this amazing manga that I saw.
You actually have an answer for that.
I think it's called Planetes, where it's basically space janitors, and their entire job is to be out there and pick up all this shit that's in the orbit so that this stuff can't happen. And honestly, I think we just need space janitors.
I was just about to kind of muse that was my new science fiction idea. I'm glad someone has done it. I have too many projects
space,
already.
Space janitors.
Yes.
Well, I will say to end this, I think that we just need to channel Insane Clown Posse and say, magnets... how do they work? I don't want to talk to a scientist.
And that's the show, guys. If you want to check us out, if you're not familiar, we're at skippyandfanny.com. So thank you very much for coming.
I like that you did like the family-friendly version of the Insane Clown Posse.
Woo! You did it!
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
skippyandfanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo. Signing off.